It might just be the ultimate travel experience, being an expat. You know, you take your life and you move it across to a whole different country. You immerse yourself in another culture, in another destination. You learn so much about things that you wouldn't normally as a tourist. I've got a friend from Argentina who calls it traveling without moving, this idea of going to another place and just staying in one spot for a while and really getting to know it and really, really sort of getting down into the intricacies of that place. You know, you meet interesting people, you eat great food, you have incredible experiences, but at the same time, you kind of find out about the bad parts about a country as well that you would miss when you're in the tourism bubble. Hi, I'm Ben Groundwater, and you're listening to Flight of Fancy, the Traveller podcast. Today, we're going to have a chat about the expat life, the good things and the bad things. Immersing yourself in another place and getting to know the locals, getting to know the other expats as well in some places. And joining me to do that, we have two traveller.com.au writers who are absolute experts in the field. Firstly, we have Uta Juncker, who lived in Munich for 2 years.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, Uta. And also we have joining us Catherine Marshall, who is not an expat. She's actually a migrant and came from South Africa, has lived here since 2002.
Hi, Ben.
And later on, we're going to be joined by someone who chose to live in the coldest and one of the most polluted places in the entire world. So what do you guys think? Is it the ultimate way to travel, to shift yourself somewhere else and live there for a couple of years?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Did you feel, when you moved over here, did you feel like you were an Australian straight away, or did it take a long time to make that shift?
Oh, absolutely not. No, yeah. It actually took years. And I think that's, as a migrant, you come with a different set of expectations. You come with the knowledge that you have broken off your connections in a way. You've started a new life for yourself.
What about you were just saying about, you know, the sense of this arrival, and obviously, you know, you're going, you read about it, you sort of have a sense. Do you remember what was the first thing that struck you when you actually went, oh yeah, they do things differently here?
I can't say that I remember the precise thing or the time of day, or, you know, the moment when it happened, but there were many amusing and sometimes baffling experiences in those early days. One of them was the expression to bring a plate.
Now, oh, don't tell me you
yes,
actually did.
This is brilliant.
Many South Africans. And I'm not sure if this is what happens with other...
My mum did this exact same thing yeah. when she moved to Western Australia from the UK.
Oh, is that
she was
so?
Invited to a barbecue and
she
and told
brought
to
an
bring
empty plate.
She thought maybe there's a lot of people there and
yes.
maybe they just don't have enough crockery.
That's strange.
That makes sense.
Usually, would you like me to bring a glass with my bottle of wine? So, yes, that type of thing. And I had always assumed, you know, for a South African moving to Australia, we are not changing hemispheres. We're not changing weather, you know, climate. In some cases, we're not even changing sporting codes. And yet,
just the team you support.
Possibly, yes. These things might change over time, depending who's the stronger team at the time. But, and where you're not changing language, which is also an incredibly difficult thing for people who are living an expatriate existence in a country whose language they don't speak or have no knowledge of. And yet, despite this, the cultural differences are so vast that settling into this new country can be quite difficult. And that was a huge surprise to me.
And how did you find the social rules here? Because I know, so in Germany, for instance, and in many ways, my transition was really easy in Germany because I was grown up in the culture. I spoke the language. To a large degree, I knew what to expect. But you'd hit little things like, because I was editing a magazine, because I was the boss. My employees, we all got on great. It was very relaxed, but they felt a bit uncomfortable socializing with me because, you know, I was the boss. I've just come home from Denmark and I was talking to an expat in Denmark who was saying, because I was saying, I love the Danes, they're so friendly. She was going, yeah, but they don't let you in. And then I was talking to some Danes about it and they said the same thing. They said, when we finish work, we socialise with our family. You know, it was very different rules to how it is in Australia.
Yeah, right. And I've got an American friend who moved over to Australia. And one of the things that she found with dealing with Australians was, you can't be brash and overly confident, and because it's sort of perceived as arrogance in Australia. And she found that especially with going to work. In the US, you're expected to tell everyone that you want to be the CEO in 2 years. If you don't do that, you're looked at as being sort of lazy and not ambitious in the slightest. And she got over here and was acting like that, and everyone sort of looked at her like, "Who do you think you are, love?" And,
yes.
and you know, just sort of shunned her. And she yes. realized that the attitudes over here, you have to sort of work your way in softly
exactly.
rather than be sort of overconfident.
Yes. And of course, South Africans can be, this is, I learned to perceive my own people differently, because it had never occurred to me that we might be loud and arrogant and brash. But I've been told by many Australians that's exactly what we are. To which I then reply, well, we're very similar then, aren't we?
I think it's the stuff that you take for granted that shocks you. Like, I remember there was a situation where I had this opportunity to go to Africa, to go to Kenya and Tanzania, but I had to get both visas, and my passport had to go to the embassy in Berlin by mail, and I had to do this all within a week. And I just went, it's impossible. I can't get it to Berlin and back from Munich twice in a week. And so I went to the post office to ask if they had some sort of express post like we've got here. And I explained what they wanted, and they went, yeah, that's the post. And I went, no, you don't understand. It has to get to Berlin overnight, then come back overnight, then get to Berlin overnight, and then come back overnight. They went, yeah, that's the post.
Yeah, you don't understand. You're in Germany now.
And you know what? They were dead right. They got back on the Thursday. So it was those little things that I – and then, of course, the things like the stuff that I didn't so much notice, but I used to have friends come from London or whatever. And one afternoon we were out for a walk in the big park there called the Englischer Garten. And we were just walking and my friend just stopped and stared. And I'm like, what's wrong? He went, those people. I'm looking at the people going, yeah. He went, they're sunbathing. And I'm like, yeah. I went, they're sunbathing nude. I went, yeah. He went, they're office workers. They've got their suits and ties next to them in a small, and they're sunbathing nude in their office hours. I'm going, oh yeah, they don't do that in London. Yeah.
Was German nudity something that you were prepared for?
Oh,
when
yeah.
you got there? Yeah.
It's fine.
So what was your motivation for moving to Germany for a while?
I'd always sort of had it in the back of my head that it was something I would like to try, because I do feel very German. Mm. And then I got this job offer actually offered to me on a plate, which was fantastic. And so I went, and it was pretty much, most of it was as expected. I found myself hitting small blocks, like the fact that there was no Sunday trading.
Right.
And which I kind of knew going in. And I mean, I'd spent a lot of time in Germany over the years, and you kind of work around it. But when you suddenly, it's your whole thing. You're working Monday to Friday, and suddenly you've got these 2 days, and suddenly everything that has to be done has to happen on the Saturday because everything's shut on the Sunday. And I found that quite an imposition. But the most interesting thing for me was, over that course of the first year, I found myself changing and getting more German.
Right.
Perhaps to a level that wasn't good. And there were a couple of triggers for me. Like, I used to go and visit friends in London on the weekend, and I remember the first times I went. So Munich, to give you context, is a very conservative city. And so I would hop on the tube at Heathrow, and I would be surrounded by, you know, rasters and punks and sort of derelict-looking people and life in its rich panoply. And I'd be going, oh, thank God, you know. And I noticed that towards the end of the first year, I was getting on that tube and looking around going, can't they just smarten themselves up? Because it was just a bit messy. And I mean, I think the moment that I kind of went, oh no, this is not good, was it was lunchtime, and I had to go into town, and it was snowing, and it was April. And, you know, I liked the snow because it was a novelty for me, but it was April and I was a bit over the snow. And plus, in Munich, the snow, it either comes straight down or it comes from the west, or you get the swirling snow that goes round and round and gets in every crack, and I hate that. And of course, this day was the swirly snow. And so I'm staring out at the snow, sort of cursing quietly under my breath. And one of my staff said to me, and for a start, this is so German, one of my staff said to me, but you like the snow. You know, I had taken a position on the snow, and I had to stick to that. And it was one of those things, I started saying it and I could hear myself saying, I was going, no, because I was saying, I like the snow when it falls in an orderly fashion. I was like, all right, you're too German. You need to move back to Australia.
So can I ask you, did you start to view Australia differently from your position in Germany?
That's an interesting question. I think probably not, because I think the German and the Australian things were things I'd thought about growing up, because I did have, if you like, the two sides. But what I did notice when I did come back, pretty much one of the first things I did was go for a bushwalk. And I kind of got freaked out by how weird the bush was. And I thought, I haven't been gone that long and it's already looking really alien to me. And that was interesting, how quickly not just you align culturally and you also align visually with what you're seeing.
Yeah. Did you feel very comfortable in Germany straight away?
Yeah, I did. I did, except the thing that really freaked me out was in Germany, once you're a woman of a certain age, you are automatically addressed as Mrs. Mm-hmm. rather than Miss. So I was Frau Juncker rather than Fräulein Juncker. And that was freaky because Frau Juncker is my mother.
One of the interesting things I've found about expat life is you tend to gravitate towards other expats because they're the people who, you know, you automatically have something in common with, but also they're the ones who are up for making friends and they want to meet new people and it's all exciting and interesting like it is for you. Whereas the people who live there,
they've got their
lives and they're not as quick to let you into that.
Yeah, and I think I'll tell you, the great tragedy, if you like, of my stay in Germany was I did have one German who made the effort to be my friend and invited me over, and then I lost her number. Oof.
So she probably still thinks that you just...
Yeah, Gabi, if you're out there, I didn't dump you. You're a really nice girl. You're the only one who made the effort.
What about you, Catherine? How did you make friends? Who did you make friends with when you got here?
Well, I had a similar experience where I just didn't make friends for quite a while, probably because I suppose I was also, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I had children. So it makes it easier in the sense that you can actually make friends through your children because they're making friends and you're then having to deal with their parents. That doesn't always translate into a friendship, and you're not necessarily going to make friends with the parents of your children's friends. So it took a long time to happen, but I think I live in a community where there are a lot of migrants, and I think a lot of the people who've been there long term have migrant fatigue. And you could almost see the look on their faces as you know, as you came along feeling, you know.
Here comes another one.
Oh, God, she's going to try and be my friend.
I just can't do
where,
this.
Where are
Sorry.
The migrants from in your area?
There are quite a few from South Africa. Mm-hmm. They're increasingly from China, mm-hmm. From the UK, New Zealand. We have some Americans. But there is a large South African population. We didn't know that it was full of South Africans, but we found a house.
It's like Australians who moved to Putney are like,
hey, yes,
where exactly. Are the other Australians come from?
Yeah. and we found a house that we could afford to rent. And then when we discovered that the suburb was full of South Africans, my husband actually said, well, if we are ever able to afford to buy a house in Sydney, which we very much doubted at that time, we certainly won't be living here. You know, we're going to live with the Aussies. But of course, we're still there and absolutely love it. And gradually over the years, we did make friends initially with fellow South African migrants, simply because, as you alluded to, Ben, they were friendless. And so, you know, when you find another friendless person, you get together and you become friends.
Yeah, and you have that experience in common
you
as well.
You do. And I think, and some of those, I only have honestly probably one or two of those friends who've stayed really good friends, because that was a friendship that was built on something beyond the shared migrant experience. But the rest really have fallen by the wayside. And of course, I've made
because
friends.
They were emergency friends.
They were, you know, exactly. I'm sorry to say, I'm a bit fickle that way.
You're listening to Flight of Fancy. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can find stories by our guests and other great writers at traveller.com.au. How do you feel about South Africa when you go back now? Because I know you travel back there through work a little bit. What's it like when you get back and see, you know, this place that you've left?
I love it. I mean, it's one of those, I think, as you would probably feel, well, no doubt about Australia, there is something you have in common with your countrymen that you cannot find anywhere else in the world.
Does it feel like home to you still?
Oh, absolutely. It's you belong. You know, you are familiar with the geographical landscape. You're familiar with the psychological landscape. You can make jokes that people will understand and they won't look at you blankly. you can use certain words like lacquer and shame and ach no.
Oh, shame.
Yes. Shame. And people won't look at you as if you're a little bit mad.
You know, I got to say, I used to read a lot of Wilbur Smith books when I was a kid and I was obsessed with Africa and South Africa and this ach thing. I didn't realize that the G was sort of said in a Dutch kind of way. And I always read it as ag. And I got to South Africa and someone said to me, ach man. And I was like, that makes so much sense. It sounds so much better when you say it like
doesn't
that.
Doesn't it?
Yes, I get
it's
it.
Very descriptive. Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, but I mean, you do just, I think the place where you were born, those are your people. And you have to reach a point, and I've probably reached this about 2 years after I migrated, where I think I felt that I was somehow being unfaithful to my motherland in loving Australia. And one day I said to myself, I'm perfectly capable of loving both of these countries, and that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
There's enough of me to go
exactly.
around.
So now I think one of the things that we've been talking about is all of us moving to different countries, but they've all been sort of Western countries and we've moved from Western countries. And so there's that sort of little bit of recognizability in those places. What happens though when you move to somewhere completely different where you have no cultural touchstones and where you're far away from home and you don't speak the language? To talk about that, we've got Jessica Rafal with us. She spent a year living in Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia, working in development, and has some pretty interesting tales. Jess, thanks for coming along.
No worries.
What possessed you to want to move to Ulaanbaatar?
Well, I'd actually applied for a job as part of like an AusAid volunteering program. And so the job that I got was in Ulaanbaatar. I didn't actually choose the city because I probably would have chosen somewhere else.
So briefly, paint us a picture. What is Ulaanbaatar like?
Okay, so Ulaanbaatar is the capital city of Mongolia. The whole country has 3 million people and 1 million of those live in Ulaanbaatar, or UB as it's called. It's really cold in winter, down to sometimes minus 40 degrees, and it's really polluted because a lot of people have to burn whatever they can get their hands on to stay warm during the cold. So it's kind of a developing post-Soviet city, not too beautiful to look at, and it's pretty rough.
Jess, did you have a moment? I imagine when you arrived, you know, it's there is quite an extreme culture shock, but you're finding accommodation, you're getting settled, you're doing the job, you're sorting yourself out. But was there a moment, a couple of weeks or a month or so in, when you just went, oh, wow, this is a really weird place and I don't know if I can deal with it?
Well, yeah, basically. When I got there in October, as the kind of slide into winter begins, and begins fairly rapidly. You're right. Like when you're in the sort of rush of getting everything sorted, it's all exciting and it's new. And then when you sort of have to go to work every day and you're sort of settled into a more ordinary life and it's getting colder and colder and you have to wear your pollution mask and you start thinking, oh, God, have I made a terrible mistake? But I never really, I always knew that I would stay I was only there for a year and I knew that I would always stay for the year.
Okay. So what I want to know is, how did you cope with the winter?
it's hard to explain because it's so cold that it's not really on the normal spectrum of weather that you experience in most of your life. It's its own whole thing. It's so big and looming as this kind of feature of your life that you just have to think about it every time you're deciding on anything to do or considering anything. The weather is there as this kind of huge
factor that you need to take into account. So if you're meeting someone before meeting up with someone and then going off to a restaurant, no one can be late, because otherwise it gets a little bit dangerous, really, because you're out in the cold waiting at night and it's freezing cold and you just sort of max out at about 5 minutes before you just need to go and get inside, because
so it's not otherwise... so much be on time because otherwise it's annoying, it's be on time because otherwise I'll be dead.
Yeah, it's much closer to the second one. Yes.
Jess, how do you think living in such a challenging environment has shaped you?
Well, quite profoundly, actually. It's really given me a confidence that I can live just about anywhere, excepting kind of really violent or kind of politically volatile places, which are, I think, in their own category. I can... The weather, the pollution, the food, everything was so much of a challenge that getting through that year has really left me with a sense of, well, really I can do anything. And and that's still, I still have that several years later. I still kind of have that confidence and I know that I got it in Mongolia.
Is there anything you miss about Mongolia?
I do miss that. There's a certain ease to an expat life when your friendship group is all of you. How do I explain this? Everyone I know in the whole country is in that group, and that's true for everyone else in that group. So there's no other real commitments that anyone has, and it's so easy to just say, should we just go and get a beer? Should we go and get dinner? Everyone lives really close to each other, and there's this ease to the social interactions that you just don't have in your sort of ordinary life or home life, when everyone has a million other things to do and people they know, and there's all of this challenge to kind of get together. So I really do miss that kind of fun, social, easy aspect to it.
But not the food.
I do not miss the food.
What was your big sort of takeaway about Mongolia? You know, did you get to like any aspects of it, or do you sort of see it as this, you know, this strange experience that you'll look back on, you know, in an interesting way, but may not necessarily love?
Well, the longer I stayed there, the more I felt like I just didn't understand it at all. There are these. And anyone who's travelled in a developing country will see this. I think there's these stark contradictions. There's this huge, obscene wealth in some areas contrasted with this really grinding poverty, and this welcoming and hospitality that you encounter in the people out in the countryside compared with this really kind of fairly permanent low-level hostility that I experienced as a foreigner in Mongolia in my day-to-day life. And so trying to grapple with those inconsistencies and contradictions is difficult, but you do, I think, come away with more of a sense of a country, because all countries are like that, all places are like that. There's no one takeaway from any country. And the longer that you stay somewhere, the more you can understand that. And I think that's a much truer sense of a country, is to be able to start to understand some of those contradictions.
Jess, did you have, did the distance from Australia give you a different or altered perception of your own country, of Australia?
Yeah, totally. When you come back to Australia and everything is so easy and available, and you go to these huge shopping centres where there's just everything that you could want, and it's sort of nice, but it's also kind of upsetting and a bit obscene, really, the excesses that we have in Australia and other Western countries. And they are really, I mean, it's such a cliche, but they really are so striking after coming back from time away in a more developing nation. You really do
really do notice them, and I found myself quite troubled by them for a long time. But obviously, as with all of those experiences, they fade and you become inured to all those things again once you've been back for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing to me. It's always been amazing how quickly you fall back into your normal way of life and start lusting after iPhones and great jeans and everything, even though, you know, 2 weeks ago you were thinking that this is all excessive and ridiculous. But yeah, Jess, thank you very much. That was fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, Uta and Catherine, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating. Now, people, if they want to read your work or also my work, they can go to traveller.com.au and check out some stories there. Otherwise, we'll be back on Flight of Fancy next time. And if you'd like to subscribe to the podcast, you can find us in iTunes or on your favourite podcasting app.